Chapter 11. Minimum Wage Laws. Supply and demand says that above market prices create unsaleable surpluses, but that has not stopped most of Europe from regulating labor markets into decades of depression level unemployment. Ryan Kaplan. Just as we can better understand the economic role of prices in general when we see what happens when prices are not allowed to function, so we can better understand the economic role of workers' pay by seeing what happens when that pay is not allowed to vary with the supply and demand for labor. Historically, political authorities set maximum wage levels centuries before they set minimum wage levels. Today, however, only the latter are widespread. Minimum wage laws make it illegal to pay less than the government-specified price for labor. By the simplest and most basic economics, a price artificially raised tends to cause more to be supplied and less to be demanded than when prices are left to be determined by supply and demand in a free market. The result is a surplus, whether the price that is set artificially high is that of farm produce or labor. Making it illegal to pay less than a given amount does not make a worker's productivity worth that amount, and if it is not, that worker is unlikely to be employed. Yet minimum wage laws are almost always discussed politically in terms of the benefits they confer on workers receiving those wages. Unfortunately, the real minimum wage is always zero, regardless of the laws, and that is the wage that many workers receive in the wake of the creation or escalation of a government-mandated minimum wage, because they either lose their jobs or fail to find jobs when they enter the labor force. The logic is plain, and an examination of the empirical evidence from various countries around the world tends to back up that logic, as we shall see. Unemployment. Because the government does not hire surplus labor the way it buys surplus agricultural output, a labor surplus takes the form of unemployment, which tends to be higher under minimum wage laws than in a free market. Unemployed workers are not surplus in the sense of being useless, or in the sense that there is no workaround that needs doing. Most of these workers are perfectly capable of producing goods and services, even if not to the same extent as more skilled or more experienced workers. The unemployed are made idle by wage rates artificially set above the level of their productivity. Those who are idled in their youth are, of course, delayed in acquiring the job skills and experience which could make them more productive, and therefore higher earners, later on. That is, they not only lose the low pay they could have earned in an entry-level job, they lose the higher pay that they could have moved on to and begun earning after gaining experience in entry-level jobs. Younger workers are disproportionately represented among people with low rates of pay in countries around the world. Only about 3% of American workers over the age of 24 earn the minimum wage, for example. Although most modern industrial societies have minimum wage laws, not all do. Switzerland has been a rare exception and has had very low unemployment rates. In 2003, The Economist magazine reported, "Switzerland's unemployment neared a five-year high of 3.9% in February. Swiss labor unions have been trying to get a minimum wage law passed, arguing that this would prevent exploitation of workers. However, the Swiss cabinet still rejected the proposed minimum wage law in January 2013. Its unemployment rate at that time was 3.1%. Singapore likewise has no minimum wage law, and its unemployment rate has likewise been 2.1%. Back in 1991, when Hong Kong was still a British colony, it too had no minimum wage law, and its unemployment rate was under 2%. In the United States, during the Coolidge administration, the last administration before there was any federal minimum wage law, the annual unemployment rate got as low as 1.8%. The explicit minimum wage rate understates the labor costs imposed by European governments, which also mandate various employer contributions to pension plans and health benefits, among other things. Higher costs in the form of mandated benefits have the same economic effect as higher costs in the form of minimum wage laws. Europe's unemployment rates shot up when such government-mandated benefits, to be paid for by employers, grew sharply during the 1980s and 1990s. In Germany, such benefits accounted for half of the average labor cost per hour. By comparison, Such benefits accounted for less than one-fourth the average labor costs per hour in Japan and the United States. Average hourly compensation of manufacturing employees in the European Union countries in general is higher than in the United States or Japan. So is unemployment. Comparisons of Canada with the United States show similar patterns. Over a five-year period, Canadian provinces had minimum wage rates that were a higher percentage of output per capita than in American states, and unemployment rates were correspondingly higher in Canada, as was the average duration of unemployment, while the Canadian rate of job creation lagged behind that in the United States. Over this five-year period, three Canadian provinces had unemployment rates in excess of 10%, with a high of 16.9% in Newfoundland, but none of the 50 American states averaged unemployment rates in double digits over that same five-year period. A belated recognition of the connection between minimum wage laws and unemployment by government officials has caused some countries to allow their real minimum wage levels to be eroded by inflation, avoiding the political risks of trying to repeal these laws explicitly, when so many voters think of these laws as being beneficial to workers. Such laws are in fact beneficial to those workers who continue to be employed, those who are on the inside looking out, but at the expense of the unemployed who are on the outside looking in. Labor unions also benefit from minimum wage laws and are among the strongest proponents of such laws, even though their own members typically make much more than the minimum wage rate. There is a reason for this. Just as most goods and services can be produced with either much labor and little capital, or vice versa, so can most things be produced using varying proportions of low-skilled labor and high-skilled labor, depending on their respective costs relative to one another. Thus, experienced unionized workers are competing for employment against younger, inexperienced, and less skilled workers, whose pay is likely to be at or near the minimum wage. The higher the minimum wage goes, the more the unskilled and inexperienced workers are likely to be displaced by more experienced and higher skilled unionized workers. Just as businesses seek to have government-imposed tariffs on imported goods that compete with their own products, so labor unions use minimum wage laws as tariffs to force up the price of non-union labor that competes with their members for jobs. Among 3.6 million Americans earning no more than the minimum wage in 2012, just over half were from 16 to 24 years of age, and 64% of them worked part-time. Yet political campaigns to increase the minimum wage often talk in terms of providing a living wage sufficient to support a family of four, such families as most minimum wage workers do not have, and would be ill-advised to have, before they reach the point where they can feed and clothe their children. The average family income of a minimum wage worker is more than $44,000 a year, far more than can be earned by someone working at minimum wages. But 42% of minimum wage workers live with parents or some other relative. In other words, they are not supporting a family, but often a family is supporting them. Only 15% of minimum wage workers are supporting themselves and a dependent, the kind of person envisioned by those who advocate a living wage. Nevertheless, a number of American cities have passed living wage laws, which are essentially local minimum wage laws specifying a higher wage rate than the national minimum wage law. Their effects have been similar to the effects of national minimum wage laws in the United States and other countries. That is, the poorest people have been the ones who have most often lost jobs. The huge financial, political, emotional, and ideological investment of various groups in issues revolving around minimum wage laws means that dispassionate analysis is not always the norm. Moreover, the statistical complexities of separating out the effects of minimum wage rates on employment from all the other ever-changing variables which also affect employment mean that honest differences of opinion are possible when examining empirical data. However, when all is said and done, most empirical studies indicate that minimum wage laws reduce employment in general, and especially the employment of younger, less skilled, and minority workers. A majority of professional economists surveyed in Britain, Germany, Canada, Switzerland, and the United States agreed that minimum wage laws increase unemployment among low-skilled workers. Economists in France and Austria did not. However, The majority among Canadian economists was 85%, and among American economists was 90%. Dozens of studies of the effects of minimum wages in the United States, and dozens more studies of the effects of minimum wages in various countries in Europe, Latin America, the Caribbean, Indonesia, Canada, Australia, and New Zealand, were reviewed in 2006 by two economists at the National Bureau of Economic Research. They concluded that, despite the various approaches and methods used in these studies, this literature as a whole was one largely solidifying the conventional view that minimum wages reduce employment among low-skilled workers. Those officially responsible for administering minimum wage laws, such as the U.S. Department of Labor and various local agencies, prefer to claim that these laws do not create unemployment. So do labor unions, which have a vested interest in such laws as protection for their own members' jobs. In South Africa, for example, The Economist reported, "The main union body, the Congress of South African Trade Unions, COSATU, says joblessness has nothing to do with labor laws. The problem, it says, is that businesses are not trying hard enough to create jobs." In Britain, the Low Pay Commission, which sets the minimum wage, has likewise resisted the idea that the wages it set were responsible for an unemployment rate of 17.3% among workers under the age of 25, at a time when the overall unemployment rate was 7.6%. Even though most studies show that unemployment tends to increase as minimum wages are imposed or increased, those few studies that seem to indicate otherwise have been hailed in some quarters as having refuted this myth. However, one common problem with some research on the employment effects of minimum wage laws is that surveys of employers before and after a minimum wage increase can survey only those particular businesses which survived in both periods. Given the high rates of business failures in many industries, the results for the surviving businesses may be completely different from the results for the industry as a whole. Using such research methods, you could survey people who have played Russian roulette and prove from their experiences that it is a harmless activity, since those for whom it was not harmless are unlikely to be around to be surveyed. Thus, you would have refuted the myth that Russian roulette is dangerous. It would be comforting to believe that the government can simply decree higher pay for low-wage workers without having to worry about unfortunate repercussions, but the preponderance of evidence indicates that labor is not exempt from the basic economic principle that artificially high prices cause surpluses. In the case of surplus human beings, that can be a special tragedy when they are already from low-income, unskilled, or minority backgrounds and urgently need to get on the job ladder, if they are to move up the ladder by acquiring experience and skills. Unemployment varies not only in its quantity as of a given time, it varies also in how long workers remain unemployed. Like the unemployment rate, the duration of unemployment varies considerably from country to country. Countries which drive up labor costs with either high minimum wages or generous employee benefits imposed on employers by law, or both, tend to have longer-lasting unemployment, as well as higher rates of unemployment. In Germany, for example, there is no national minimum wage law, but government-imposed mandates on employers, job security laws, and strong labor unions artificially raise labor costs anyway. As of the year 2000, 51.5% of the unemployed in Germany were unemployed for a year or more, while just 6% of the unemployed in the United States were unemployed that long. However, as the U.S. Congress extended the period during which unemployment compensation would be paid, the share of Americans who remained unemployed for a year or longer rose to 31.3% in 2011, compared to 48% in Germany. Informal minimum wages. Sometimes a minimum wage is imposed not by law, but by custom, informal government pressures, labor unions, or, especially in the case of third world countries, by international public opinion or boycotts, pressuring multinational companies to pay third world workers wages comparable to the wages usually found in more industrial developed countries. Although organized public pressures for higher pay for third world workers in Southeast Asia and Latin America have made news in the United States in recent years, such pressures are not new nor confined to Americans. Similar pressures were put on companies operating in colonial West Africa in the middle of the 20th century. Informal minimum wages imposed in these ways have had effects very similar to those of explicit minimum wage laws. An economist studying colonial West Africa in the mid-20th century found signs telling job applicants that there were no vacancies almost everywhere. Nor was this peculiar to West Africa. The same economist, P.T. Bauer of the London School of Economics, noted that it was a striking feature of many underdeveloped countries that money wages are maintained at high levels while large numbers are seeking but unable to find work. These were, of course, not high levels of wages compared to what was earned by workers in more industrialized economies, but high wages relative to third world workers' productivity and high relative to their alternative earning opportunities, such as in agriculture, domestic service, or self-employment as street vendors and the like. That is, in sectors of the economy not subject to external pressures to maintain an artificially inflated wage rate. The magnitude of the unemployment created by artificially high wages that multinational companies felt pressured to pay in West Africa was indicated by Professor Bauer's first-hand investigations. I asked the manager of the tobacco factory of the Nigerian Tobacco Company, a subsidiary of the British American Tobacco Company, in Ibadan, whether he could expand his labor force without raising wages if he wished to do so. He replied that his only problem would be to control the mob of applicants. Very much the same opinion was expressed by the Kano District agent of the firm of John Holt & Company in respect of their tannery. In December 1949, a firm of produce buyers in Kano dismissed two clerks and within 2 days received between 50 and 60 applications for the posts without having publicized the vacancies. The same firm proposed to erect a groundnut crushing plant. By June 1950, machinery had not yet been installed, but without having advertised the vacancy, it had already received about 700 letters asking for employment. I learnt that the European-owned brewery and the recently established manufacturers of stationery constantly receive shoals of applications for employment. Nothing had changed fundamentally more than half a century later, when 21st century job seekers in South Africa were lined up far in excess of the number of jobs available, as reported in the New York Times. When Tiger Wheels opened a wheel plant 6 years ago in this faded industrial town, the crush of job seekers was so enormous that the chief executive, Eddie Kaizan, ordered a corrugated iron roof to shield them from the midday heat. There were hundreds and hundreds of people outside our gate, just sitting there in the sun for days and days, Mr. Kaizan recalled in an interview. We had no more jobs, but they refused to believe us. Why then did wage rates not come down in response to supply and demand, leading to more employment at a lower wage level, as basic economic principles might lead us to expect? According to the same report, in other developing countries, legions of unskilled workers have kept down labor costs, but South Africa's leaders, vowing not to let their nation become the West's sweatshop, heeded the demands of politically powerful labor unions for new protections and benefits. Such protections and benefits included minimum wages set at levels higher than the productivity of many South African workers. The net result was that when Tiger Wheels, which had made aluminum wheels solely in South Africa for 2 decades, expanded its production, it expanded by hiring more workers in Poland, where it earned a profit, rather than in South Africa, where it could only break even or sustain a loss. The misfortunes of eager but frustrated African job applicants throughout the South African economy were only part of the story. The output that they could have produced, if employed, would have made a particularly important contribution to the economic well-being of the consuming public in a very poor region, lacking many things that others take for granted in more prosperous societies. It is not at all clear that workers as a whole are benefited by artificially high wage rates in the third world. Employed workers, those on the inside looking out, obviously benefit, while those on the outside looking in lose. For the population as a whole, including consumers, it would be hard to make a case that there is a net benefit, since there are fewer consumer goods when people who are willing to work cannot find jobs producing those consumer goods. The only category of clear beneficiaries are people living in richer countries, who can enjoy the feeling that they are helping people in poorer countries, or third world leaders too proud to let their workers be hired at wage rates commensurate with their productivity. While South African workers' productivity is twice that of workers in Indonesia, they are paid five times as much when they can find jobs at all. In short, these productive South African workers are not surplus or unemployable in any sense other than being priced out of the market by politicians. As already noted in Chapter 10, South African firms use much capital per worker. This is more efficient for the firms, but only because South African labor laws make labor artificially more expensive, both with minimum wage laws and with laws that make laying off workers costly. Labor costs are more than 3.5 times higher than in the most productive areas of China and a good 75% higher than in Malaysia or Poland, according to The Economist. With such artificially high costs of South African labor, it pays employers to use more capital, but this is not greater efficiency for the economy as a whole, which is worse off for having so many people unemployed, which is to say, with so many resources idled instead of being allocated. South Africa is not unique. A National Bureau of Economic Research study comparing the employment of low-skilled workers in Europe and the United States found that since the 1970s, such workers have been disproportionately displaced by machinery in European countries where there are higher minimum wages and more benefits mandated to be paid for by employers. The study pointed out that it was since the 1970s that European labor markets moved toward more control by governments and labor unions, while in the United States, the influence of government and labor unions on labor markets became less. The net result has been that, despite more technological change in the United States, the substitution of capital for labor in low-skilled occupations has been greater in Europe. Sometimes the work of low-skilled labor is not displaced by capital, but simply dispensed with, as the study noted. It is close to impossible to find a parking attendant in Paris, Frankfurt, or Milan, while in New York City they are common. When you arrive even in an average hotel in an American city, you are received by a platoon of bag carriers, door openers, etc. In a similar hotel in Europe, you often have to carry your bags on your own. These are not simply trivial traveler's pointers, but indicate a deeper and widespread phenomenon. Low-skilled jobs have been substituted away for machines in Europe, or eliminated, much more than in the U.S., while technological progress at the top, that is, at the high-tech sector, is faster in the U.S. than in Europe. Just as a price set by government below the free market level tends to cause quality deterioration in the product that is being sold, because a shortage means that buyers will be forced to accept things of lower quality than they would have otherwise, so a price set above the free market level tends to cause a rise in average quality, as the surplus allows the buyers to cherry-pick and purchase only the better quality items. What that means in the labor market is that job qualification requirements are likely to rise, and that some workers who would ordinarily be hired in a free market may become unemployable when there are minimum wage laws. Unemployability, like shortages and surpluses, is not independent of price. In a free market, low productivity workers are just as employable at a low wage rate as high productivity workers are at a high wage rate. During the long era from the late 19th century to the mid-20th century, when black Americans received lower quantities and lower qualities of education than whites in the South where most lived, the labor force participation rates of black workers were nevertheless slightly higher than those of white workers. For most of that era, there were no minimum wage laws to price them out of jobs, and even after a nationwide minimum wage law was passed in 1938, the wartime inflation of the 1940s raised wages in the free market above the legally prescribed minimum wage level, making the law largely irrelevant by the late 1940s. The law was amended in 1950, beginning a series of minimum wage escalations. If low-wage employers make workers worse off than they would be otherwise, then it is hard to imagine why workers would work for them. Because they have no alternative, may be one answer. But that answer implies that low-wage employers provide a better option than these particular workers have otherwise, and so are not making them worse off. Thus, the argument against low-wage employers making workers worse off is internally self-contradictory. What would make low-wage workers worse off would be foreclosing one of their already limited options. This is especially harmful when considering that low-wage workers are often young entry-level workers for whom work experience can be more valuable in the long run than the immediate pay itself. Differential impact. Because people differ in many ways, those who are unemployed are not likely to be a random sample of the labor force. In country after country around the world, those whose employment prospects are reduced most by minimum wage laws are those who are younger, less experienced, or less skilled. This pattern has been found in New Zealand, France, Canada, the Netherlands, and the United States, for example. It should not be surprising that those whose productivity falls furthest short of the minimum wage level would be the ones most likely to be unable to find a job. In Australia, the lowest unemployment rate for workers under the age of 25 during the entire period from 1978 to 2002 never fell below 10%, while the highest unemployment rate for the population in general barely reached 10% once during that same period. Australia has an unusually high minimum wage, relatively speaking, since its minimum wage level is nearly 60% of that country's median wage rate, while the minimum wage in the United States has been less than 40% of the American median wage rate. In early 21st century France, the national unemployment rate was 10%, but among workers under the age of 25, the unemployment rate was more than 20%. In Belgium, the unemployment rate for workers under the age of 25 was 22%, and in Italy, 27%. During the global downturn in 2009, the unemployment rate for workers under the age of 25 was 21% in the European Union countries as a whole, with more than 25% in Italy and Ireland, and more than 40% in Spain. As American laws and policies moved more in the direction of those in other modern industrial nations in the early 21st century, the unemployment rate among Americans who were from 25 to 34 years old went from being lower than unemployment rates in the same age bracket in Canada, Britain, Germany, France, and Japan in 2000 to being higher than in these same countries in 2011. Some countries in Europe set lower minimum wage rates for teenagers than for adults, and New Zealand simply exempted teenagers from the coverage of its minimum wage law until 1994. This was tacit recognition of the fact that those workers less in demand were likely to be hardest hit by unemployment created by minimum wage laws. Another group disproportionately affected by minimum wage laws are members of unpopular racial or ethnic minority groups. Indeed, minimum wage laws were once advocated explicitly because of the likelihood that such laws would reduce or eliminate the competition of particular minorities, whether they were Japanese in Canada during the 1920s or blacks in the United States and South Africa during the same era. Such expressions of overt racial discrimination were both legal and socially accepted in all three countries at that time. The history of black workers in the United States illustrates the point. As already noted, from the late 19th century on through the middle of the 20th century, the labor force participation rate of black Americans was slightly higher than that of white Americans. In other words, blacks were just as employable at the wages they received as whites were at their very different wages. The minimum wage law changed that. Before federal minimum wage laws were instituted in the 1930s, the black unemployment rate was slightly lower than the white unemployment rate in 1930. But then followed the Davis-Bacon Act of 1931, the National Industrial Recovery Act of 1933, and the Fair Labor Standards Act of 1938, all of which imposed government-mandated minimum wages, either on a particular sector or more broadly. The National Labor Relations Act of 1935, which promoted unionization, also tended to price black workers out of jobs, in addition to union rules that kept blacks from jobs by barring them from union membership. The National Industrial Recovery Act raised wage rates in the southern textile industry by 70% in just 5 months, and its impact nationwide was estimated to have cost blacks 500,000 jobs. While this act was later declared unconstitutional by the Supreme Court, the Fair Labor Standards Act of 1938, establishing a national minimum wage, was upheld by the High Court. As already noted, the inflation of the 1940s largely nullified the effect of the Fair Labor Standards Act until it was amended in 1950 to raise minimum wages to a level that would have some actual effect on current wages. The unemployment rates of young black males during the late 1940s, the years prior to the repeated escalations of the minimum wage that began in 1950, contrast sharply with our unemployment rates in later years. As of 1948, for example, the unemployment rate for blacks aged 16 to 17 years was 9.4%, while that of whites the same ages was 10.2%. For blacks 18 to 19 years of age, the unemployment rate that year was 10.5%, while that of whites the same ages was 9.4%. In short, teenage unemployment rates were a fraction of what they were to become in later years, and black and white teenage unemployment rates were very similar. Even though the following year, 1949, was a recession year, rising black teenage male unemployment rates that year still did not reach 20%. The black teenage unemployment rate during the recession of 1949 was lower than it was to be at any time during even the boom years of the 1960s and later decades. Black 16 and 17-year-olds had an unemployment rate of 15.8% in the 1949 recession year, but that was less than half of what it would be in every year from 1971 through 1997, and less than one-third of what it would be in 2009. Repeated increases in the minimum wage marked these later years of much higher unemployment rates among black teenagers. The wide gap between the unemployment rates of black and white teenage males likewise dates from the escalation of the minimum wage and the spread of its coverage in the 1950s. The usual explanations of higher unemployment among black teenagers, less education, lack of skills, racism, cannot explain their rising unemployment, since all these handicaps were worse during the earlier period when black teenage unemployment was much lower. Chapter 12. Special Problems in Labor Markets. The promotion of economic equality and the alleviation of poverty are distinct and often conflicting. Peter Bauer. Although the basic economic principles underlying the allocation of labor are not fundamentally different from the principles underlying the allocation of inanimate resources, it is not equally easy to look at labor and its pay rates in the same way one looks at the prices of iron ore or bushels of wheat. Moreover, we are concerned about the conditions where people work in a way that we are not concerned about the conditions where machinery is used or where raw materials are processed, except insofar as these conditions affect people. Other issues that arise with labor that do not arise with inanimate factors of production include job security, collective bargaining, occupational licensing, and questions about whether labor is exploited in any of the various meanings of that word. The statistics that measure what is happening in labor markets also present special problems that are not present when considering statistics about inanimate factors of production. The unemployment rate is one example. Unemployment statistics. The unemployment rate is a very important statistic as an indicator of the health of the economy and society. But for that very reason, it is necessary to know the limitations of such statistics. Because human beings have volition and make choices, unlike inanimate factors of production, many people choose not to be in the labor force at a given time and place. They may be students, retired people, or housewives who work in their own homes, taking care of their families, but are not on any employer's payroll. Children below some legally specified age are not even allowed to be gainfully employed at all. Those people who are officially counted as unemployed are people who are in the labor force, seeking employment but not finding it. Patients in hospitals, people serving in the military forces, and inmates of prisons are also among those people who are not counted as part of the labor force. While unemployment statistics can be very valuable, they can also be misleading if their definitions are not kept in mind. The unemployment rate is based on what percentage of the people who are in the labor force are not working. However, people's choices as to whether or not to be in the labor force at any given time means that unemployment rates are not wholly objective data, but vary with choices made differently under different conditions and varying from country to country. Although the unemployment rate is supposed to indicate what proportion of the people in the labor force do and do not have jobs, sometimes the unemployment rate goes down while the number of people without jobs is going up. The reason is that a prolonged recession or depression may lead some people to stop looking for a job after many long and futile searches. Since such people are no longer counted as being in the labor force, their exodus will reduce the unemployment rate, even if the proportion of people without jobs has not been reduced at all. In the wake of the downturn of the American economy in the early 21st century, the unemployment rate rose to just over 10%. Then the unemployment rate began to decline, as more and more people stopped looking for jobs and thus dropped out of the labor force. The labor force participation rate declined to levels not seen in decades. Although some saw the declining unemployment rate as an indication of the success of government policies, much of that decline represented people who had simply given up looking for jobs and subsisted on resources provided by various government programs. For example, more than 3.7 million workers went on Social Security disability payments from the middle of 2009 to early 2013, the fastest enrollment pace ever, according to Investor's Business Daily. Rather than relying solely on the unemployment rate, an alternative way of measuring unemployment is to compare what percentage of the adult population outside of institutions, colleges, the military, hospitals, prisons, etc., are working. This avoids the problem of people who have given up looking for work not being counted as unemployed, even if they would be glad to have a job if they thought there was any reasonable chance of finding one. In the first half of 2010, for example, while the unemployment rate remained steady at 9.5%, the proportion of the non-institutional adult population with jobs continued a decline that was the largest in more than half a century. The fact that more people were giving up looking for jobs kept the official unemployment rate from rising to reflect the increased difficulty of finding a job. Things become more complicated when comparing different countries. For example, The Economist magazine found that more than 80% of the male population between the ages of 15 and 64 were employed in Iceland, but fewer than 70% were in France. Any number of things could account for such differences. Not only are there variations from country to country in the number of people going to college, but there are also variations in the ease or difficulty with which people qualify for government benefits that make it unnecessary for them to work, or to look for work, or to accept jobs that do not meet their hopes or expectations. High as the unemployment rate has been in France for years, French unemployment statistics tend to understate how many adults are not working. That is because the French welfare state makes it easier for senior citizens to withdraw from the labor force altogether, and unemployment rates are based on the size of the labor force. Thus, while more than 70% of people who are from 55 to 64 years of age are working in Switzerland, only 37% of the people in that same age bracket are working in France. The point here is that while people who choose not to look for work are not employed, they are also not automatically classified as unemployed. Therefore, statistics on employment rates and unemployment rates do not necessarily move in opposite directions. Both rates can rise at the same time or fall at the same time, depending on how easy or how difficult it is for people to live without working. Unemployment compensation is one obvious way for people to live for some period of time without working. How long that time is and how generous the benefits are vary from country to country. According to The Economist, unemployment compensation in the United States pays lower benefits for less time and to a smaller share of the unemployed than in other industrialized countries. It is also true that unemployed Americans spend more time per day looking for work, more than four times as much time as unemployed workers in Germany, Britain, or Sweden. Even 5 years after losing his job, a sacked Norwegian worker can expect to take home almost three-quarters of what he did while employed, The Economist reported. Some other Western European countries are almost as generous for the first year after losing a job. Spain, France, Sweden, and Germany pay more than 60% of what the unemployed worker earned while working, but only in Belgium does this level of generosity continue for 5 years. In the United States, unemployment benefits usually expire after 1 year, though Congress has, at some times, extended these benefits longer. There are various kinds of unemployment, and unemployment statistics alone cannot tell you what kind of unemployment currently exists. There is, for example, what economists call frictional unemployment. People who graduate from high school or college do not always have jobs waiting for them or find jobs the first day they start looking. Meanwhile, job vacancies remain unfilled while there are unemployed people looking for work, because it takes time for the right employers and the right workers to find one another. If you think of the economy as a big, complex machine, then there is always going to be some loss of efficiency by social versions of internal friction. That is why the unemployment rate is never literally zero. Even in boom years, when employers are having a hard time trying to find enough people to fill their job vacancies. Such transient unemployment must be distinguished from long-term unemployment. Countries differ in how long unemployment lasts. A study by the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development showed that among the unemployed, those who are unemployed for a year or more constituted 9% of all unemployed in the United States, 23% in Britain, 48% in Germany, and 59% in Italy. In short, even the difference between American and European rates of unemployment as a whole understates the difference in a worker's likelihood of finding a job. Ironically, it is in countries with strong job security laws, like Germany, where it is harder to find a new job. Fewer job opportunities in such countries often take the form of fewer hours worked per year, as well as higher unemployment rates and longer periods of unemployment. One form of unemployment that has long stirred political emotions and led to economic fallacies is technological unemployment. Virtually every advance in technological efficiency puts somebody out of work. This is nothing new. By 1830, Barthélemy Timonier, a French tailor who had long been obsessed with the idea, had patented and perfected an effective sewing machine. When 80 of his machines were making uniforms for the French army, Paris tailors, alarmed at the threat to their jobs, smashed the machines and drove Timonier out of the city. Such reactions were not peculiar to France. In early 19th century Britain, people called Luddites smashed machinery when they realized that the Industrial Revolution threatened their jobs. Opposition to technological efficiency, as well as other kinds of efficiency, ranging from new organizational methods to international trade, has often focused on the effects of efficiency on jobs. These are almost invariably the short-run effects on particular workers, in disregard of the effects on consumers or on workers in other fields. The rise of the automobile industry, for example, no doubt caused huge losses of employment among those raising and caring for horses, as well as among the makers of saddles, horseshoes, whips, horse-drawn carriages, and other paraphernalia associated with this mode of transportation. But these were not net losses of jobs, as the automobile industry required vast numbers of workers, as did industries producing gasoline, batteries, and car repair services, as well as other sectors of the economy catering to motorists, such as motels, fast food restaurants, and suburban shopping malls. Working conditions. Both governments and labor unions have regulated working conditions, such as the maximum hours of work per week, safety rules, and various amenities to make the job less stressful or more pleasant. The economic effects of regulating working conditions are very similar to the effects of regulating wages, because better working conditions, like higher wage rates, tend to make a given job both more attractive to the workers and more costly to the employers. Moreover, employers take these costs into account thereafter when deciding how many workers they can afford to hire when there are higher costs per worker, as well as how high they can afford to bid for workers, since money spent creating better working conditions is the same as money spent for higher wage rates per hour. Other things being equal, better working conditions mean lower pay than otherwise, so that workers are in effect buying improved conditions on the job. Employers may not cut pay whenever working conditions are improved, but when rising worker productivity leads to rising pay scales through competition among employers for workers, those pay scales are unlikely to rise as much as they would have if the costs of better working conditions did not have to be taken into account. That is, employers' bids are limited not only by the productivity of the workers, but also by all the other costs besides the rate of pay. In some countries, these non-wage costs of labor are much higher than in others, about twice as high in Germany, for example, as in the United States, making German labor more expensive than American labor that is paid the same wage rate. While it is always politically tempting for governments to mandate benefits for workers, to be paid for by employers, since that wins more votes from workers than it loses among employers, and costs the government nothing, the economic repercussions seldom receive much attention from either the politicians who create such mandates or from the voting public. But one of the reasons why the unemployed may not begin to be hired as output increases, such as when an economy is rising out of a recession, is that working the existing workers overtime may be cheaper for the employer than hiring new workers. That is because an increase in working hours from existing employees does not require paying for additional mandated benefits, as hiring new workers would. Despite higher pay required for overtime hours, it may in many cases still be cheaper to work the existing employees longer instead of hiring new workers. In November 2009, under the headline, "Overtime Creeps Back Before Jobs," the Wall Street Journal reported, "In October, the manufacturing sector shed 61,000 people, while those still employed were working more hours. Overtime increased." The reason? Overtime enables companies to increase productivity to meet rising customer orders without adding fixed costs, such as healthcare benefits, for new hires. It also enables companies to meet temporary increases in demand for their products without taking on the expenses of training people, who will have to be let go when the temporary increase in consumer demand passes. The cost of training a new worker includes reducing the output of an already trained worker who is assigned to train the new worker, both of them being paid, while neither of them is producing as much output as other workers who are already trained. Although it is easier to visualize the consequences of more costly working conditions in a capitalist economy, where these can be conceived in dollars and cents terms, similar conditions applied in the days of the socialist economy in the Soviet Union. For example, a study of the Soviet economy noted that juveniles under 18 are entitled to longer holidays, shorter hours, study leave. Consequently, managers prefer to avoid employing juveniles. There is no free lunch in a socialist economy any more than in a capitalist economy. Because working conditions were often much worse in the past, fewer safety precautions, longer hours, more unpleasant and unhealthy surroundings, some advocates of externally regulated working conditions, whether regulated by government or unions, argue as if working conditions would never have improved otherwise. But wage rates were also much lower in the past, and yet they have risen in both unionized and non-unionized occupations, and in occupations covered and those not covered by minimum wage laws. Growth in per capita output permits both higher pay and better working conditions, while competition for workers forces individual employers to make improvements in both, just as they are forced to improve the products they sell to the consuming public for the same reason. Safety laws. While safety is one aspect of working conditions, it is a special aspect because, in some cases, leaving its costs and benefits to be weighed by employers and employees leaves out the safety of the general public that may be affected by the actions of employers and employees. Obvious examples include pilots, truck drivers, and train crews, because their fatigue can endanger many others besides themselves when a plane crashes, a big rig goes out of control on a crowded highway, or a train derails, killing not only passengers on board, but also spreading fire or toxic fumes to people living near where the derailment occurs. Laws have accordingly been passed, limiting how many consecutive hours individuals may work in these occupations, even if longer hours might be acceptable to both employers and employees in these occupations. Child labor laws. In most countries, laws to protect children in the workplace began before there were laws governing working conditions for adults. Such laws reflected public concerns because of the special vulnerability of children, due to their inexperience, weaker bodies, and general helplessness against the power of adults. At one time, children were used for hard and dangerous work in coal mines, as well as working around factory machinery that could maim or kill a child who was not alert to the dangers. However, laws passed under one set of conditions often remain on the books long after the circumstances that gave rise to those laws have changed. As a 21st century observer noted, child labor laws passed to protect children from dangerous factories now keep strapping teenagers out of air-conditioned offices. Such results are not mere examples of irrationality. Like other laws, child labor laws were not only passed in response to a given constituency, humanitarian individuals and groups in this case, but also developed new constituencies among those who found such laws useful to their own interests. Labor unions, for example, have long sought to keep children and adolescents out of the workforce, where they would compete for jobs with the union's own members. Educators in general, and teachers' unions in particular, likewise have a vested interest in keeping young people in school longer, where their attendance increases the demand for teachers and can be used politically to argue for larger expenditures on the school system. While keeping strapping teenagers from working in air-conditioned offices might seem irrational in terms of the original reasons for child labor laws advanced by the original humanitarian constituency, it is quite rational from the standpoint of the interests of these new constituencies. Whether it is rational from the standpoint of society as a whole to have so many young people denied legal ways to earn money while illegal ways abound is another question. Hours of work. One of the working conditions that can be quantified is the length of the work week. Most modern industrial countries specify the maximum number of hours per week that can be worked, either absolutely or before the employer is forced by law to pay higher rates for overtime work beyond those specified hours. This imposed work week varies from country to country. France, for example, specified 35 hours as the standard work week, with employers being mandated to continue to pay the same amount for this shorter work week as they had paid in weekly wages before. In addition, French law requires employees to be given 25 days of paid vacation per year, plus paid holidays, neither of which is required under American laws. Given these facts, it is hardly surprising that the average number of hours worked annually in France is less than 1,500, compared to more than 1,800 in the United States and Japan. Obviously, the extra 300 or more hours a year worked by American workers has an effect on annual output, and therefore on the standard of living. Nor are all these differences financial. According to Business Week magazine, doctors work 20% less on average. Staff shortages in hospitals and nursing homes due to the 35-hour week was a key reason August's heat wave killed 14,000 in France. The French tradition of long summer vacations would have made the understaffing problem worse during an August heat wave. Sometimes, in various countries, especially during periods of high unemployment, a government-mandated shorter work week is advocated on grounds that this would share the work among more workers, reducing the unemployment rate. In other words, instead of hiring 35 workers to work 40 hours each, an employer might hire 40 workers to work 35 hours each. Plausible as this might seem, the problem is that shorter work weeks, whether imposed by government or by labor unions, often involve maintaining the same weekly pay as before, as it did in France. What this amounts to is a higher wage rate per hour, which tends to reduce the number of workers hired, instead of increasing employment as planned. Western European nations in general tend to have more generous time-off policies mandated by law. According to the Wall Street Journal, the average European worker took off 11.3 days in 2005, compared with 4.5 days for the average American. Spain is especially generous in this regard. The Wall Street Journal in 2012 reported that in Spain, the law requires that workers receive 14 paid holidays off annually, plus 22 days of paid vacation, 15 days off to get married, and 2 to 4 days off when anyone in an employee's family has a wedding, birth, hospitalization, or death. Employees who themselves are off from work due to illness can continue to get most or all of their wages paid if they have a note from a doctor for the duration of their illness, up to 18 months. Should the employer choose to fire an ill worker, the severance pay required to compensate that worker can be up to what that worker would have earned in 2 years. Such mandated generosity is not without its costs, not simply to the employer, but to the economy in general and workers in particular. Spain has had chronically high levels of unemployment, 25% in 2012, but ranging up to 52% for younger workers. Moreover, 49% of the unemployed in Spain in the second quarter of 2013 had been unemployed for a year or more, compared to 27% in the United States. The labor market is affected not only by mandated employer benefits to workers, but also by government-provided benefits that make it unnecessary for many people to work. In Denmark, for example, a 36-year-old single mother of two was getting about $2,700 a month, and she had been on welfare since she was 16, according to the New York Times, which also noted that, in many regions of the country, people without jobs now outnumber those with them. Third World Countries. Some of the worst working conditions exist in some of the poorest countries, that is, countries where the workers could least afford to accept lower pay as the price of better surroundings or circumstances on the job. Multinational companies with factories in the Third World often come under severe criticism in Europe or America for having working conditions in those factories that would not be tolerated in their own countries. What this means is that more prosperous workers in Europe or America, in effect, buy better working conditions, just as they are likely to buy better housing and better clothing than people in the Third World can afford. If employers in the Third World are forced by law or public pressures to provide better working conditions, the additional expense reduces the number of workers hired, just as wage rates higher than would be required by supply and demand left many Africans frustrated in their attempts to get jobs with multinational companies. However much the jobs provided by multinational companies to Third World workers might be disdained for their low pay or poor working conditions by critics in Europe or the United States, the real question for workers in poor countries is how these jobs compare with their local alternatives. A New York Times writer in Cambodia, for example, noted, "Here in Cambodia, factory jobs are in such demand that workers usually have to bribe a factory insider with a month's salary just to get hired." Clearly, these are jobs highly sought after. Nor is Cambodia unique. Multinational companies typically pay about double the local wage rate in Third World countries. It is much the same story with working conditions. Third World workers compare conditions in multinational companies with their own local alternatives. The same New York Times writer reporting from Cambodia described one of these alternatives, working as a scavenger picking through garbage dumps where the stench clogs the nostrils, and where burning produces acrid smoke that blinds the eyes, while scavengers are chased by swarms of flies and biting insects. Speaking of one of these scavengers, the Times writer said, "Nep Chanda averages 75 cents a day for her efforts. For her, the idea of being exploited in a garment factory, working only 6 days a week, inside instead of in the broiling sun, for up to $2 a day, is a dream." Would it not be even better if this young woman could be paid what workers in Europe or America are paid and work under the same kinds of conditions found on their jobs? Of course it would. The real question is, how can her productivity be raised to the same level as that of workers in Europe or the United States? And what is likely to happen if productivity issues are waved aside and better working conditions are simply imposed by law or public pressures? There is little reason to doubt that the results would be similar to what happens when minimum wage rates are prescribed in disregard of productivity. This does not mean that workers in poorer countries are doomed forever to low wages and bad working conditions. On the contrary, to the extent that more and more multinational companies locate in poor countries, working conditions as well as productivity and pay are affected when increasing numbers of multinationals compete for labor that is increasingly experienced in modern production methods, that is, workers with increasing amounts of valuable human capital for which employers must compete in the labor market. In 2013, The Economist magazine reported, "Wages in China and India have been going up by 10 to 20% a year for the past decade." A decade earlier, wages in emerging markets were a tenth of their level in the rich world. But between 2001 and 2011, the difference between what computer programmers in India were paid and what computer programmers in the United States were paid constantly narrowed. The competition of multinational corporations for workers has affected wages not only among their employees, but also among employees of indigenous businesses that have had to compete for the same workers. In 2006, Business Week magazine reported that a Chinese manufacturer of air conditioner compressors has seen turnover for some jobs hit 20% annually, with the general manager observing that it's all he can do to keep his 800 employees from jumping ship to Samsung, Siemens, Nokia, and other multinationals operating in his area. In Guangdong province, factories have been struggling to find staff for 5 years, driving up wages at double-digit rates, the Far Eastern Economic Review reported in 2008. These upward competitive pressures on wages have continued. According to the New York Times in 2012, labor shortages are already so acute in many Chinese industrial zones that factories struggle to find enough people to operate their assembly lines, and often pay fees to agents who try to recruit workers arriving on long-haul buses and trains from distant provinces. That same year, the Wall Street Journal reported that average urban wages in China rose by 13% in 1 year. Competitive pressures have affected working conditions as well as wages. That means managers can no longer simply provide 8-to-a-room dorms and expect laborers to toil 12 hours a day, 7 days a week. In addition to boosting salaries, Yongjin has upgraded its dormitories and improved the food in the company cafeteria. Despite those efforts, its 5 factories remain about 10% shy of the 6,000 employees they need. In 2012, the New York Times reported that workers assembling iPads in a factory in China, who had previously been sitting on a short green plastic stool that left their backs unsupported and sore, were suddenly supplied with decorated wooden chairs with a high, sturdy back. Nor were such changes isolated, given the competitive labor markets, where even companies in different industries were competing for many of the same workers. According to the New York Times, when the largest company raises wages and cuts hours, it forces every other factory to do the same thing, whether they want to or not, said Tony Proffitt, a senior vice president at Hewlett-Packard. A firestorm has started, and these companies are in the glare now. They have to improve to compete. It's a huge change from just 18 months ago. The difference between having such improvements in working conditions emerge as a result of market competition and having them imposed by government is that markets bring about such improvements as a result of more options for the workers, due to more employer competition for workers, who are increasingly more experienced and therefore more valuable employees, while government impositions tend to reduce existing options by raising the cost of hiring labor in disregard of whether those costs exceed the labor's productivity. A free market is not a zero-sum system, where the gains of one party have to come at the expense of losses to another party, because this is a process that creates a larger total output as workers acquire more human capital. These workers, their employers, and the consumers can all benefit at the same time. However, politicians in various Asian countries have sought to simply impose higher pay rates through minimum wage laws, which can impede this process and create other problems that are all too familiar from the track record of minimum wage laws in other countries. Informal pressures for better working conditions by international non-governmental organizations likewise tend to disregard costs and their repercussions when setting their standards. Tragic events, such as the 2013 collapse of a factory in Bangladesh that killed more than 1,000 workers, create international public opinion pressures on multinational corporations to either pay for safer working conditions or to leave countries whose governments do not enforce safety standards. But such pressures are also used to push for higher minimum wage laws and more labor unions, usually without regard to the costs and employment repercussions of such things. Third-party observers face none of the inherent constraints and trade-offs that are inescapable for both employers and employees, and therefore these third parties have nothing to force them to even think in such terms. Collective bargaining. In previous chapters, we have been considering labor markets in which both workers and employers are numerous and compete individually and independently, whether with or without government regulation of pay and working conditions. However, these are not the only kinds of markets for labor. Some workers are members of labor unions, which negotiate pay and working conditions with employers, whether employers are acting individually or in concert as members of an employer's association. Employer organizations. In earlier centuries, it was the employers who were more likely to be organized and setting pay and working conditions as a group. In medieval guilds, the master craftsmen collectively made the rules determining the conditions under which apprentices and journeymen would be hired and how much customers would be charged for the products. Today, Major League Baseball owners collectively make the rules as to what is the maximum of the total salaries that any given team can pay to its players without incurring financial penalties from the leagues. Clearly, pay and working conditions tend to be different when determined collectively than in a labor market where employers compete against one another individually for workers and workers compete against one another individually for jobs. It would obviously not be worth the trouble of organizing employers if they were not able to gain by keeping the salaries they pay lower than they would be in a free market. Much has been said about the fairness or unfairness of the actions of medieval guilds, modern labor unions, or other forms of collective bargaining. Here we are studying their economic consequences, and especially their effects on the allocation of scarce resources which have alternative uses. Almost by definition, all these organizations exist to keep the price of labor from being what it would be otherwise in free and open competition in the market. Just as the tendency of market competition is to base rates of pay on the productivity of the worker, thereby bidding labor away from where it is less productive to where it is more productive, so organized efforts to make wages artificially low or artificially high defeat this process and thereby make the allocation of resources less efficient for the economy as a whole. For example, if an employer's association keeps wages in the widget industry below the level that workers of similar skills receive elsewhere, fewer workers are likely to apply for jobs producing widgets than if the pay rate were higher. If widget manufacturers are paying $10 an hour for labor that would get $15 an hour if employers had to compete with each other for workers in a free market, then some workers will go to other industries that pay $12 an hour. From the standpoint of the economy as a whole, this means that people capable of producing $15 an hour's worth of output are instead producing only $12 an hour's worth of output somewhere else. This is a clear loss to the consumers, that is, to society as a whole, since everyone is a consumer. The fact that it is a more immediate and more visible loss to the workers in the widget industry does not make that the most important fact from an economic standpoint. Losses and gains between employers and employees are social or moral issues, but they do not change the key economic issue, which is how the allocation of resources affects the total wealth available to society as a whole. What makes the total wealth produced by the economy less than it would be in a free market is that wages set below the market level cause workers to work where they are not as productive, but where they are paid more because of a competitive labor market in the less productive occupation. The same principle applies where wages are set above the market level. If a labor union is successful in raising the wage rate for the same workers in the widget industry to $20 an hour, then employers will employ fewer workers at this higher rate than they would at the $15 an hour rate that would have prevailed in free market competition. In fact, the only workers that will be worth hiring are workers whose productivity is at least $20 an hour. This higher productivity can be reached in a number of ways, whether by retaining only the most skilled and experienced employees, by adding more capital to enable the labor to turn out more products per hour, or by other means, none of them free. Those workers displaced from the widget industry must go to their second-best alternative. As before, those worth $15 an hour producing widgets may end up working in another industry at $12 an hour. Again, this is not simply a loss to those particular workers who cannot find employment at the higher wage rate, but a loss to the economy as a whole, because scarce resources are not being allocated where their productivity is highest. Where unions set wages above the level that would prevail under supply and demand in a free market, widget manufacturers are not only paying more money for labor, they are also paying for additional capital or other complementary resources to raise the productivity of labor above the $20 an hour level. Higher labor productivity may seem on the surface to be greater efficiency, but producing fewer widgets at higher cost per widget does not benefit the economy, even though less labor is being used. Other industries receiving more labor than they normally would, because of the workers displaced from the widget industry, can expand their output. But that expanding output is not the most productive use of the additional labor. It is only the artificially imposed union wage rate, which causes the shift from a more productive use to a less productive use. Either artificially low wage rates caused by an employer association or artificially high wage rates caused by a labor union reduces employment in the widget industry. One side or the other must now go to their second best option, which is also second best from the standpoint of the economy as a whole, because scarce resources have not been allocated to their most valued uses. The parties engaged in collective bargaining are, of course, preoccupied with their own interests, but those judging the process as a whole need to focus on how such a process affects the economic interests of the entire society, rather than the internal division of economic benefits among contending members of the society. Even in situations where it might seem that employers could do pretty much whatever they wanted to do, history often shows that they could not, because of the effects of competition in the labor market. Few workers have been more vulnerable than newly freed blacks in the United States after the Civil War. They were extremely poor, most completely uneducated, unorganized, and unfamiliar with the operation of a market economy. Yet organized attempts by white employers and landowners in the South to hold down their wages and limit their decision-making as sharecroppers all eroded away in the market, amid bitter mutual recriminations among white employers and landowners. When the pay scale set by the organized white employers was below the actual productivity of black workers, that made it profitable for any given employer to offer more than the others were paying in order to lure more workers away, so long as his higher offer was still not above the level of the black workers' productivity. With agricultural labor especially, the pressure on each employer mounted as the planting season approached, because the landowner knew that the size of the crop for the whole year depended on how many workers could be hired to do the spring planting. That inescapable reality often overrode any sense of loyalty to fellow landowners. The percentage rate of increase of black wages was higher than the percentage rate of increase in the wages of white workers in the decades after the Civil War, even though the latter had higher pay in absolute terms. One of the problems of cartels in general is that no matter what conditions they set collectively to maximize the benefits to the cartel as a whole, it is to the advantage of individual cartel members to violate those conditions, if they can get away with it, often leading to the disintegration of the cartel. That was the situation of white employer cartels in the postbellum South. It was much the same story out in California in the late 19th and early 20th centuries, when white landowners there organized to try to hold down the pay of Japanese immigrant farmers and farm laborers. These cartels, too, collapsed amid bitter mutual recriminations among whites, as competition among landowners led to widespread violations of the agreements which they had made in collusion with one another. The ability of employer organizations to achieve their goals depends on their being able to impose discipline on their own members and on keeping competing employers from arising outside their organizations. Medieval guilds had the force of law behind their rules. Where there has been no force of law to maintain internal discipline within the employer organization or to keep competing employers from arising outside the organization, employer cartels have been much less successful. In special cases, such as the employer organization in Major League Baseball, this is a monopoly legally exempted from antitrust laws. Therefore, internal rules can be imposed on each team, since none of these teams can hope to withdraw from Major League Baseball and have the same financial support from baseball fans or the same media attention when they are no longer playing other major league teams. Nor would it be likely or even feasible for new leagues to arise to compete with Major League Baseball with any hope of getting the same fan support or media attention. Therefore, Major League Baseball can operate as an employer organization, exercising some of the powers once used by medieval guilds before they lost the crucial support of law and faded away.